It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with two people who at one time thought they were starting small blogging projects, but have now reached millions of people all over the world. Later in the hour, I'll talk with Kate Ahrens, the creator of Wit and Delight. But first, Alex Sheen is the founder of Because I Said I Would. It started as a blog and has now become a nonprofit organization and a worldwide movement. He'll be speaking as part of the University of Iowa Lecture Series next Wednesday at the downtown Sheridan in Iowa City at 7:30. And he's here on the line with me now. Hello, Alex.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
And I know this is a story you've told many times, but for a lot of us, this is new to us. So I want to go back to the time when you lost your dad. And you wrote a eulogy about your dad to try to communicate to people what was so special about him. What did you want to tell people about him?
Yeah, my dad was really an average man in a lot of ways. But there was one thing that was really exceptional about him. His treatment of the importance of his promises, the way that he honored his commitments to me, his son, was something that I will never forget. And when he died of lung cancer 2 years ago, I came to this moment where I really realized that this was the greatest characteristic, the greatest quality of him. And so I decided to title his eulogy, Because I Said I Would. And in that would talk about the importance of a promise.
So you wanted to share that story with people at your dad's funeral, but you also decided that you wanted to keep that quality alive. How did you decide that you would do that?
Yeah, I think the thought that I couldn't come to grips with was the fact that my father's funeral was going to be just another sad day. You know, most of us have been to funerals, and we go and we look back on a life that we've lost, and then we sort of just move on. You know, maybe not much of us really change in honor of that person, and I wanted this to be different. So at my father's funeral, I handed out what I called a promise card, and this was a small piece of paper about the size of a business card, but all it said on the front was Because I Said I Would in the bottom right-hand corner, and on the back, it's nothing else. It's almost completely blank, and what you do is you write a promise on the card, maybe something small that you said today or a commitment that's big that defines your purpose on this earth. You write it on this card, you give it to someone, you tell them, I'm going to fulfill this promise, and when I do, I earn this card back. The card is a symbol of my honor, it's my property, and I'm going to earn it back from you. And so I explained this promise card and handed it out for the first time at my father's funeral. And from there, I offered to send 10 promise cards to anybody, anywhere in the world at no cost, which is a financially stupid decision. Because there's turns out there's a lot of people on that internet people talk so much about.
When did you start blogging about this?
Well, really, it started as a Facebook page. You know, as I posted this message just to let my friends and family know that I had lost my father. And in that original post, I said, you know, so many people have said, what can I do for you? What can I do for your family? And I said that you could do something for us. You could actually do something for yourself. You can look back in your life and the promises that you have left to keep. You can take one of those and you can fulfill it. And that could be in honor of my father. And that initial post is really what started it all, that Facebook page, and eventually what would become a website, and a social movement and nonprofit, really all originated from that message one day after my father died.
Do you remember the first promise card you handed to somebody?
I wrote 3 promise cards at the same time, and I left them in my father's casket. I will not get those back, but that's not the important part. It's what they mean to me and how I will honor them. And so I keep those 3 cards sort of private to myself on what they mean and what they say, but that was the first time I wrote a promise card.
When you started hearing from other people that they wanted these promise cards and you started writing more about some of the experiences that you were having. Was there a moment when you realized the power of this?
Yeah, initially it was just these little things, right? You know, I would try to set examples like, oh, I always said I'm going to change the battery in our smoke detector, right? Like, I keep telling myself I'm going to do that. You know, so I would set an example with little things that would eventually grow, and people would start to make promises. You know, I will give blood for the first time. I'll quit smoking. I'll go to my son's Little League game. You know, but that moment that you're talking about really came to me while I was at work. As this was starting to spread, I still had my job, and someone dropped off a letter to my desk at work. It was anonymous, so no name attached to it, just handwritten, college-ruled piece of notebook paper. And it said that, you know, it said, "Hi, Alex, I've been keeping up with your blog. You know, because I said I would, this message of importance of a promise really helped me through a rough patch. Many times in life I didn't think life was worth living, and I almost took my own life, almost. This person said that if it wasn't for these promise cards, then maybe they wouldn't be around." And I really knew what that meant. And so I sat at my desk that day and I cried. You know, I thought about what my father would say about this letter, about this message. I thought about who this person, you know, writing this message to me. Like, I looked around my office wondering who it was. But I knew at that moment that I needed to leave my job. And so eventually I would ask for a meeting with my boss. I would go into that meeting. She didn't know what it was about. I went to the meeting with this letter in my hand and with the intention of resigning. I gave it to her. I said, "Can you just read this?" So she, you know, reads the premise of what I just said to you. She looks up at me and says, "Alex, this is from my daughter." And this anonymous message that hadn't even no name on it ends up being my boss's daughter and is what drove me to leave my job. I think that was one of the moments when I received that letter that I realized the importance of a promise is much greater than just the little things in life. It spans every piece of our existence.
Leaving your job was a huge leap for you in a lot of ways. You also were making a pretty clear decision that you would never make as much money as you were making at that point, or at least wouldn't for a long time. How did you come to terms with that?
Yeah, you know, we receive messages like the one I just described, sometimes 1,000 in a day. You know, sometimes they're just thank yous, but sometimes they're about their stories of commitments and born from tragedy in their life, and you can only receive so many of those before you start to realize that life is much deeper than this dollar. You know, yeah, I was working at Fortune 100, best places to work, you know, enterprise software company, youngest manager, six-figure income, blah, 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 but it just really wasn't adding up to me when I was getting these promises from all these people. I felt that I had a duty to fulfill, and that money could never fill that hole. So I decided to quit. I went unemployed for quite a long time, dug myself even deeper into financial hardship. But I would eventually come out of that with a sustainable social movement and nonprofit organization that helps others.
You have said that when you first printed those promise cards, the very first ones, mm-hmm. that you weren't particularly good at keeping promises yourself at that point. What do you mean?
Yeah. You know, it's something that's shameful to me, but my father will never know the man that I would become. You know, when he died, I was not a person of my word. Was I a horrible person? No. But you couldn't always trust if I said, "Oh, yeah, I'll be there." You know, I could make an excuse. I think a lot of people do that, and I was one of them. And so I would have to go on a journey myself to become a person of my word and to honor the things that I say. And in that, you know, I had to do quite a few things to help myself. You know, one of the things early on, one of the sort of projects that I did was a New Year's promise. instead of making a New Year's resolution, just one, I made 52 different promise cards, and I put them in a hat, and each week I randomly select one out of a hat. You know, some of them were like to give blood, to pick up trash on the side of the road. Some of them were like just teach my grandma how to Skype, you know, because she's an old Korean lady who doesn't know how to use a computer. You know, and in that journey of consistently keeping my promises and holding myself to even that weekly commitment, I was able to pull myself out of where I was into being someone, I believe, who honors his word.
How did your friends react to what you were going through? I mean, you went through a major life upheaval.
Yeah. You know, there were a lot of people who were supportive that believed in this thought of the importance of a promise, but they didn't quite understand that why I would leave that prosperity, you know, and I had one friend who just told me that I was going through an emotional crisis, that I was trying to have my father live on, in even though he was very gone, you know, this is some kind of emotional release or coping mechanism, you know, and I don't even know if I can refute that, you know, but what I do know is what the message has meant to others and the promises that they make, you know, soldiers overseas, even little kids promising that they're going to sleep in their own room because they're afraid of the dark. You know, whatever journey I went through to emotionally cope with the loss of my father, you know, is one thing, but if it means something to somebody else, then that's something I should share. And so at first, you know, I think they were supportive just because they didn't know I was going to leave my job. But then as the closer I got to leaving it, some people were very tentative about starting this nonprofit. And I went with my gut.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Alex Sheen. He is the founder of Because I Said I Would. He'll be speaking at the University of Iowa, part of the lecture series, next Wednesday in Iowa City. And I would love to hear your stories this hour, too. If you have a story of a powerful promise, give us a call, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Right now I'm talking with Alex Sheen. He's the founder of the nonprofit organizations Because I Said I Would. It's an organization based on the power of promises. He'll be speaking as part of the University of Iowa Lecture Series next Wednesday at the Iowa City Downtown Sheridan at 7:30. The lecture's open to the public. And we want to hear from you this hour as well. Is there a powerful promise that you've made to someone that affected your life, or maybe a promise that someone made to you that has been powerful? We'd love to hear your story. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Alex, when you printed up those first promise cards and you said, I'll send 10 of these promise cards to anyone, anywhere, free of charge, where did that idea come from? Why did you think a card was a good idea?
You know, some of it came from even my own need. I have a horrible memory. Like, I just forget. I'm very forgetful. And I know when I write something down, it creates this event that I just remember. I'm like, oh, yeah, I've got to do that. So that was one reason why. I also wanted it to be something that could hold you accountable. You know, when you write this card and you give it to someone and you say, I'm going to fulfill this promise and this card is a symbol of my honor, I think that creates more accountability in the commitment you're making. And not only that, it gives you something that you could even take a picture of and share on social media. You say you're going to run this 5K or marathon in benefit of a charitable organization. You know, you post that on social media with this card and the unique look of your handwriting, I think that also creates a lot of positive peer pressure to better humanity in your own ways. So there are a couple of reasons why I thought this card would be better than just simply a message said with words, and that's how I came up with the idea.
Do you think that there's something in that act of writing something down?
Absolutely. You know, there's been a lot of studies done about handwriting, its effect on our memory. But, you know, there's one study from the Dominican University of California, Dr. Gail Matthews just did two of these groups, you know, one just verbally committed to something, the other wrote it down, and goal attainment rates increased over 40% in the second population. You know, I think it's something that inherently and intuitively, I would say, helps us, but I think it's also backed by, you know, some studies on why writing it down, documenting your promises, your commitments is a very positive thing.
Can you remember the first promise card that someone shared with you that really kind of blew you away, that went beyond some of the maybe the promises you were expecting people to make?
Yeah. You know, there have been so many, but I remember one, one from last year where a young man posts this card that says, "I will always fight heroin." And, you know, you don't know what it quite means, right? There's always a story behind a promise. And I read it, and he says in July that he was found dead in the back of his girlfriend's pickup truck, that the Portland police brought him back to life. They revived him. And at that moment, he realized that he could not fight this battle alone. And so he said in this post on Instagram that he was committing himself to rehab, not just for himself, but for his family. And the next part, you know, it jarred me. He said, you know, after doing heroin, he was 23 years old, he'd been doing heroin for 9 years. He said he has a child on the way and that he wanted this card in 20 years clean and to give this to his child. You know, like, it's messages like that I'll never forget, and I'll always be able to remember because of how they made me feel about the importance of a promise to myself, how they made me reflect on the own self-improvement that I need to have in life to better humanity in what ways I can. So I think that's one example.
Now, he was making a promise to his unborn child. He was also making a promise to himself. Mm-hmm. Do you find that you get more promises to ourselves or more promises to other people that people are sharing with you?
I think it's a split. I think when we look at the commitments in our lives, the best place to start often is with ourselves. The promise to quit smoking, the promise to maybe lose weight, or, you know, the things that are in our control is a first point of reflection. My father used to always say, "Alex, the only person in this world you can control is yourself." And I believe that, and I think that's a lot of the reason why people look to make these commitments to themselves first and then look outward into their families and then into their communities and how they can help from there.
You said it was a bad financial decision to say that you would send out 10 of these cards to anybody anywhere in the world who requested them. How bad a financial decision has that been? How many of these cards have you sent?
Sure. So in the beginning, before, because I said I would level out and take care of itself financially, I spent about $27,000 on postage, stamps, you know, even just to keep the website up and server costs. Things like that. No salary dollars in there, just, you know, the pure cost of these cards and keeping that commitment myself alive that I would send these cards. But that time has gone, and we're a little bit more stable now as a nonprofit. But since September 4th, 2012, the day my father passed away, we've distributed over 2.1 million promise cards to over 105 different countries and by request only.
This has all happened in just over 2 years.
Yes, my father died late 2012.
Wow. You have done a lot of things for different organizations, for different individuals that you feel need help, whether it's sending kids to Disney World. You also walked across the state of Ohio to raise awareness about the young women who were kept captive and sexually abused by their captor. And I'm curious about how you found your mission? I mean, how did you decide beyond these promise cards, beyond facilitating this kind of interaction for other people, how did you decide what you yourself would do to make an impact on others' lives?
Yeah, there's a lot of things that sort of built up to that. And I'm about to butcher a quote from Albert Einstein, but he said, you know, leading by example is not the primary way of influencing others. It's the only way. I just thought to myself, you know, how can I possibly attempt to fulfill this mission of the betterment of humanity through promises made and kept if I am not to do exactly what I said that others should consider, you know? And so, you know, that's why I chose this path of making commitments to help other people, to show that as individuals, as single people, we can make promises to help other. You know, just a small example, I went to a bar locally here, and I stood outside with this dry erase board saying that I would give people rides home for free, you know, if they've been drinking, you know, just to get them home safely in honor of someone who passed away from drinking and driving. And, you know, I just drove people home. I mean, not that I would necessarily advise doing that because it's somewhat dangerous, but it's like something that me as an individual, I could do. You know, I could walk across the state of Ohio for Amanda Berry, Gina DeJesus, and Michelle Knight. I could raise funds for them to rebuild their lives. I could raise awareness for the victims of sexual violence. You know, there's, I want to make it things that as individuals, whether it's a small thing or a big thing, we look at ourselves and say, enough about the excuses of, oh, these problems are caused by the government or the schools or it's the teachers or it's the whatever. At some point, it comes down to us and the decisions that we make, the promises that we keep that change this world. And I wanted to do that myself, or otherwise I felt like I was living a lie.
I'm talking with Alex Sheen. He is the founder of Because I Said I Would, which started out as a Facebook post a couple of years ago, turned into a blog, and now it's a nonprofit organization and a worldwide movement based on the power of making and keeping promises. He'll be speaking at the University of Iowa next week. And Alex, now that you have put yourself out there, you've been involved in a number of different organizations, do you have people asking you to do things for them now?
Yeah, I mean, people, you know, reach out to ask in support of their initiatives, and, you know, there's certain things that we can help with. Often I speak at for and on behalf of nonprofit organizations to help with their efforts, and so that has brought me around the world. But, you know, I try to look at what we support financially and where we contribute some of our funds, and I try to put that in the spirit of that of importance of a promise. And to put that into context, you know, we recently made a post about the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, obviously a topic of note throughout the world right now. And, you know, I mentioned the statistics behind how many people have passed away from this disease and how it's spreading, but not because to cause panic, not to talk about this paranoia, but actually to speak in honor of the deep regard I have for the commitments of these medical professionals and volunteers who are caring for the infected. I mean, the promise to take care of someone through that risk and sacrifice is a pinnacle of human greatness. It is, you know, this disease is not something that we can kill with guns. You know, this is something where a shield is stronger than a thousand swords. But who is going to hold that shield? You know, it's these medical professionals that risk their lives for us. And so that's why we contributed $5,000 to Doctors Without Borders. That's why we're asking others to make contributions to this nonprofit. And so when we reach out to help people, it's often because we see a connection with the importance of a promise and how they're honoring a commitment. And so I guess that would be one example.
A year ago, you helped to publicize a video that was created by a young man who had been a drunk driver and had killed someone else in a drunk driving accident. He came to you because he wanted to become accountable, to take responsibility for his life. And he also told you that now that he has taken someone else's life. He felt like he needed to live for both of them. When he came to you, how did you respond?
Yeah, you know, initially when I received that message from Matthew Cordell on August 9th of 2013, you know, there's a part of me that thought, you know, this 22-year-old kid, maybe they just seen because I said I would go viral, and maybe he just wants to get a lighter sentence or sympathy through social media or something, right? That was one of the thoughts that was floating in the back of my head as he told me about how he killed this man in a drunk driving crash. But what I realized after speaking with attorneys is that if I were to agree to record the video that was ultimately released, that this video, prior to any charges being pressed, this confession, you know, there would be no sympathy, right? It's not a movie. This is not a game. You know, you put something out there like that, and they will throw the book at you. And so after I realized that, I needed to make sure that he also realized that. And after I did, I would eventually agree to film the confession video that you're speaking of, and then I would release it through our YouTube account for Because I Said I Would. And within 3 days, it had over a million views.
And he's now spent a year in prison, right?
It has been 1 year of incarceration for Matthew Cordell. And I actually went into prison to film a second video, and that is also on our YouTube account. And it has a different message in it, and it's a very powerful one.
Is your mom still alive?
My mom is alive. She's in Columbus with my brother, and they're both doing very well, and they're supportive of me in this odd journey I've chosen. But they are proud.
What has her reaction been?
Well, you know, my mom. Always used to joke, like when I was young, she would joke about this fictitious thing called the Mom's Club. It's just a joke for like the thing she says to her friends, right? And she would say, "Oh, I've got nothing to take to Mom's Club," you know, like if it was achievement in sports. So she'd, "Oh, I'll take that to Mom's Club." So now she feels like she has lots of things to talk about at Mom's Club.
When you think about the man you were,
yes,
2 years ago, and you think about the man you are today, how has this journey changed you?
You know, I'm not going to lie, I feel a lot more stress. You know, there's certain parts of keeping your promise, keeping your word that make you a little more on edge, and it takes some of my free spirit away. And I don't think that's a horrible thing, though, because while I still do very much enjoy life, in a different way than I used to, I think that I have something new that I really never had before, and that was a sense of honor. And, you know, in life, you can steal my shoes, you can take the shirt off my back, my car, my house. You can take all those things, but you can never take my honor. You know, that is something I would have to give away. And that has given me such a strong sense of purpose in life that I really never had. So I think that's one of the chief things that's changed about me. I'm always on time now. You know, if I say I'm going to be there, if I'm even a minute late, that is not a good thing. That's another thing. You know, when you're the founder of Because I Said I Would,
people are going to hold you accountable to every little thing, aren't
every
they?
Little thing, you know, and that's where the stress comes in. But there's also a lot of, like I said, there's honor in the way that I live now that I didn't have before. So
of all of the things that you have now done as part of making your promises and keeping your promises, is there one that feels most valuable to you?
You know, I don't know why, but this promise to give blood is something that I think about a lot. I think it's symbolic for a few reasons. One, I had a slight fear of, you know, this massive needle and, you know, giving my blood and so I think, you know, when we look at the challenges we overcome, a lot of it has to do with fear. And so doing that for the first time meant something to me. And then physically giving a part of myself to save another, to help them through injury or sickness, is something that was actually, it was inspired by a supporter, and is something that I look at as one of, in one of the commitments, although, you know, smaller, only a couple hours of my day, I look back at and I really think it's maybe more symbolic than impactful, but it means something to me. That's one of the promises that I reflect on a lot.
Alex, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alex Sheen is the founder of Because I Said I Would. It's a nonprofit and a worldwide social movement. He'll be speaking as part of the University of Iowa Lecture Series next Wednesday at the Downtown Sheraton Hotel at 7:30 in Iowa City. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Kate Ahrens graduated from Iowa State University in 2006 with a degree in graphic design. It wasn't long after that that she started her blog, Wit and Delight, while building her career. Now Wit and Delight is her career, and she's reached millions of people with her style, humor, and ideas. She's on the line with us now. Hello, Kate.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I want to go back to 2009 when you started this blog. What was your original idea?
Well, the original idea was that I really didn't know what my sense of style was. You know, and I was a junior designer and the stock market had, you know, wreaked havoc on a lot of small businesses. So I was lucky to have a job that had a little bit of time on my hands, kind of waiting for new projects to come in. So I used that time to jump into the internet and use blogging as an expression and a venture for sort of self-discovery. And it's pretty exciting to see how far it's come along.
Certainly. How did you go about attracting attention to your blog? A lot of people start blogs and a lot of it is self-discovery.
It is. And it's such a great platform for that. And I think that's why it caught on so quickly and, you know, why the audiences became so big and bloggers became so influential, because what really resonates with people is the vulnerability that comes with putting yourself out there, the willingness to let other people sort of see your missteps and sort of declarations of fashions as you sort of, you know, move through your 20s. And you know, I think they feel like you kind of make friends, you know, in the process. And you know, it never really was about gaining a huge following for me. And at that time, you know, blogs were really the only form of social media. Twitter had just come into, you know, into our radars. And that's when microblogging really took content that was on blogs and made it even more sort of bite-sized and approachable and easier to consume than ever. So I think when bite-sized blogging became, you know, or they call it microblogging became big, that's really when Wit and Delight took off, Pinterest specifically.
All right. And there are people who don't use Pinterest. So when Pinterest was launched also by an Iowan, the site is a way to share ideas. Pins are, mm-hmm. are what they're called, but they share links to many blogs all over the internet. You were one of the early adopters. What appealed to you about Pinterest?
The thing that appealed to me most about what Ben created with Pinterest was how seamless it worked into my workflow and how close it was to what I was already doing, collecting images and ripping them out of magazines and pinning them on my wall. So when I heard about it, I was like, oh, this is exactly what I've been looking for. I've been looking for, you know, sort of a way to make sure I kept all my links intact and I didn't have to have these massive binders of, you know, things that I had ripped out of El Decor. I could save them right there and organize them by boards and then share them with my friends and family. You know, now I use them to share with my husband ideas about art decor, and I'm making holiday lists right now as well. So it really fit into my lifestyle, and it became a very, very quick product I really relied on and still do.
And Pinterest is a way you can connect with a lot of other people. If people like the stuff that you pin, then they follow mm-hmm. you and get ideas from you. And your following has grown and grown and grown. Mm-hmm. You now have more than 2.6 million followers on Pinterest. Do you remember that moment when you crossed the 1 million mark?
You know, it all happened so fast, and I honestly hadn't really paid attention until I started seeing these comments, and I looked at the following count, and it was going up by, you know, 50,000 a day, and that's when I sort of realized that something was happening, but Pinterest didn't really send out a note sort of saying, you know, hey, you've been featured, get excited. So I think that the million mark kind of happened, you know, while I was a little bit stunned, I think, from the attention. But it's such a broader audience that I get to talk to on Wit and Delight. And so I really try to kind of see what they're interested in and sort of take, I don't know, take a temperature of what's going out there in the broader landscape. And, you know, it's mostly women on Pinterest, and they're so willing to give their opinion. You know, sometimes they have harsh opinions, but they're so willing to sort of take your inspiration and consider it. And I think that that's really exciting. It kind of created a space for women on the internet that wasn't already there, and it empowered them to participate in a way that they hadn't been able to before. And I think that's what's the most interesting about the platform.
So a lot of people started noticing you and following you. When did businesses then also say, hey, wait a minute, we need to pay attention to her?
You know, I think when you have, you know, anything that has, you know, a million followers, brands begin to notice. So I noticed that as soon as those numbers began appearing next to my name. But pretty early on, some, you know, tech savvy people realized the earning potential of Pinterest. And it's such an easy way for retailers to put their product out there in an organic way that doesn't feel like marketing. So, you know, when people realize how quickly their you know, pink dress could get in front of the right people, that's when they started calling. And it happened pretty immediately after Pinterest went from its core users to, you know, as their following grew or users grew, so did my opportunity within, you know, monetizing off of brand relationships with Pinterest.
With a lot of people who blog and do things online, brands approach them. I know a lot of people will feature a brand in exchange for stuff from that brand. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have to imagine that you had to be pretty savvy in negotiating to monetize this relationship, as opposed to just say, hey, we'll send you this pink dress if you'll pin it.
It's, you know, I think people realize that it, you know, these are people who are kind of sitting at home and, you know, they think, oh, well, it's nice to get something for free in exchange for coverage. But the problem is that when we have a following that people trust your opinion, the first thing that came to my mind was, okay, you know, how do I keep their trust, but still make this a viable business? So I've been pretty choosy with who I've partnered with. I've never accepted product that I didn't think I would really appreciate or want to, you know, write a review about. And products that I do get that don't look up to snuff, I send them back and I give the brand feedback. So in that way, you just have to really make sure that, you know, a brand built around trust of their followers, it can be taken away so quickly with a misstep or the wrong alignment. Or if you become a little bit too, I don't know, if it becomes too much of a sort of for-profit operation all the time. So it's a balance of all of those things. There's no roadmap. And, you know, I think every day I kind of assess the decisions I make and try to make them a little bit better and, you know, balance the trust of my followers with where I'd like to take Wit and Delight in the future.
What was the moment when you realized, hey, I can do this for a living?
You know, I probably should have done it a lot earlier. I realized that I could do it for a living when it could support the other side of my business, which is design and brand strategy. And that hasn't gone away. It's really just become a vehicle for me to put my services in front of more people and to show how, you know, my design work and show really, you know, how I can better align with certain companies. So in that way, I realized that it was worth a leap of faith to take the time to market Wit and Delight as a boutique kind of agency, a little studio that not only could produce great content for marketing purposes, but also could reposition your brand, look at new identities, give retail strategy, all of the culmination of the freelance work I had done before. I kind of put those all together, and I'm working on a little bit better way to kind of tie that package together. But you know, mostly Wit and Delight provides freedom to try out a lot of different things, and that freedom is worth the risk and, you know, not having a steady salary.
When looking at your blog at Wit and Delight, I see that you have a number of contributors who also share their ideas. Mm-hmm. Are they employees? Do you pay them for their contributions?
They are people who are contributors, sort of like I do not pay them. They are up inspiring bloggers. They are inspiring photographers, business owners. And so being on Wit and Delight is a good brand alignment for them. And in turn, you know, I have contributors that really talk about that content in a way that adds a different, unique perspective. So that's sort of how it works right now. They do like one post a month. And the exposure is sort of the trade in that, the time and the commitment to put together posts for Wit and Delight.
Now, you had a big moment last February. Target announced that you and two other top Pinterest tastemakers are going to have collections featured in stores. So what is your relationship with Target? How did you go about working on this limited edition collection?
So they approached me about a year ago. They had worked with Joy, one of the core bloggers and Pinterest influencers on the platform. And they talked to Pinterest about who would be a good fit to connect with new and different segments of possible Target customers. And Wit and Delight came up, and you know, the design background really helps when you're going in to create a product line, and when you're going in to create, you know, just do that design process. So they, you know, they liked that I had a design background. They really liked the Wit and Delight aesthetic. It had a really strong point of view. And so it was sort of a cold call. I got an email one day from someone in the curation department, and they asked if I could meet them for coffee. And that was the beginning of it.
What is a day in your work life like?
It's very different every day. When you wear so many hats, it sort of becomes pretty chaotic. I just hired a project manager, so she sort of puts together the agenda for each day, and we have status on Monday and Wednesday of every week. And so on a Monday, we'll come in and talk about what emails came in. Kelly, my project manager, will talk about some of the proposals she's working on. We're working on a book right now, so she's sort of transcribing a lot of the conversations that we're having and kind of putting it together, piecing it together into a proposal. So we'll work on that. I have two pretty big design clients right now. One of them is the Polad Family Foundation up here in Minnesota, and it's a big nonprofit naming project and branding project. So I presented that this week. Also doing some work for Red Wing Shoe Company, so sometimes they'll be up here, and I'll meet with them on, you know, their marketing strategy. And then, you know, at night, it's usually when I blog and pin. So it's sort of day-to-day working on projects, managing emails, kind of chipping away at the big stuff, and then at night is really when I do the pinning and the Instagramming and, you know, all the stuff that lives out in the world that people kind of touch and feel every day.
You share so much of yourself, and I mean, I know that this was something you did in addition to your job for a long time, so I can imagine that took a lot of your time. Do you have a hard time drawing boundaries? Is there a point at which you feel like you're giving too much of your energy and too much of yourself to the rest of the world?
Yeah, you know, I actually, before we got on the phone, I'm working on a blog post right now. Talking about a technology detox. I've actually deleted Instagram and Twitter and Facebook from my phone, and I'm going to go without until next Friday. So, and the reason why I'm doing that is because I do have a little bit of a hard time disconnecting myself from everything that's happening on Wit and Delight. In terms of sharing personal content, the line I really draw is, does it add value and can I help someone else in a similar situation? So when I talk about some of my personal experiences with, you know, either anxiety or depression or my divorce, I think about all the women out there that are probably going through the same thing and think that they're the only one, or they don't really know anyone who's gone through that and worked through it and sort of bounced back. So it's not so much a platform for me to sort of share, you know, dear diary stories. I want them to be fully formed, and I want them to mean something and provide, you know, provide value. So in that way, you know, my husband and I and my family, we're all pretty private. You know, I don't feel the pressure to put certain things out in the world that, you know, that people don't need to know or that doesn't pertain to Wit and Delight. And so that acts as a really nice line in the sand for me. you know, to know when to cross and not to cross
it. Does it feel like it takes your life 24 hours a day sometimes?
Right now, it definitely does.
Yeah.
It for sure does. So, you know, it's something I think that everyone is really struggling with right now. You're all connected all the time. And, you know, how do you figure out when it bleeds into your life too much? And that's really what next week I'm going to focus on. And, you know, the first thing I wanted to do when I deleted my Twitter app was to tweet about it. And it was this gut reaction. And I was like, oh, my gosh, this is going to be a long, you know, 8 days. But that's the whole point, is sort of discover where those sort of, you know, sort of knee-jerk reactions are, and trying to figure out really where is it adding value, really where is it important to my business, and when do I really need to shut that phone off and just be present.
Now, you have created a personal brand that appeals to a lot of people and appeals to a lot of businesses, and you've created a career for yourself out of this. I'm sure there are a lot of young people who look at you, and maybe not young people who look at you and think, man, I would love to do that. But it seems like there's so many elements of chance that go into actually being able to make a living doing what you're doing. Do you have advice for other people?
You know, I do have advice, and I think you are right that, I mean, just like so many things that are sort of abnormal, there's a lot of luck, there's a lot of hard work that goes into it. I think those are two things that you can, you know, either say happen to you, or you can open yourself for opportunity for them to, you know, happen. So when I started blogging, I always knew there was an opportunity to reach more people. I put myself out there and I did the best that I could, and they came. So I think being in the right place at the right time, be open to new things and places where exciting things are happening, especially with social media, and where, you know, you can be much more entrepreneurial with less capital these days. And that's exactly, you know, what I saw in Wit and Delight and blogging. But you can't formulate it so much that, especially within when it's a personal brand, that you sort of destroy the essence of where the sort of magic happens. I think if I had come into Wit and Delight like a, you know, corporation with a sort of super outlined and rigid approach to my social media strategy, it definitely wouldn't have the following it does today. I think people would have looked at it.
Yeah.
As you know, just, sorry.
Yeah, no, just as someone trying to make money is what they would have seen. I understand exactly what you're saying.
Well,
Kate,
we are
out of time, but thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you too. All right, I'll talk to you.
All right. Thanks
talk
a
later.
Lot. Yep. Kate is the creator of Wit and Delight, and she has reached millions of people over a number of different online platforms. This is Talk of Iowa coming up at noon today, River to River with Ben Kiefer. What's on the show?
Very quickly, Charity, Planet Money fans, stay tuned at noon. We'll be talking with Jacob Goldstein and David Kestenbaum of the Planet Money team. We'll welcome your questions as well. That coming up at noon.
All right. Thanks a lot, Ben. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.